As we're forced to social distance, people most at risk are experiencing loneliness.
How do we maintain physical distancing while at the same time trying to reach out to those that are most vulnerable?
I'm Shamitha Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, and for today on The Takeaway, Wednesday, May 6th, we'll look for ways to communicate with the elderly in our life who we may not be able to see in person. Then, lessons from the way the U.S. handled the pandemic in 1918.
Closure orders and these gathering bans are very difficult to re-implement a second time after they're removed, and that was certainly the case in 1918.
Also, how Brazil's president is actively undermining public health efforts to fight COVID-19. And then we round out the show with a look at the challenges for Hollywood.
You just can't imagine a Mission Impossible shooting in all these different countries in the next year or so.
Let's get into it. Earlier this week, we talked about the high number of COVID-19 deaths linked to long-term care facilities, like nursing homes and assisted living communities. Last week, a USA Today investigation connected more than 16,000 deaths in these facilities to the coronavirus. But as we've reported on this show, that number is almost certainly an undercount. On Tuesday, New York State announced more than 1,700 COVID-19 deaths of long-term care residents that had not been previously reported, bringing the total in that state to nearly 5,000 people. In an attempt to limit the spread of coronavirus, most long-term care facilities are no longer allowing family members or friends to visit residents, and interactions between people living in these facilities are also being limited. And that means for many elderly people, social distancing rules can increase feelings of loneliness.
Really, the way we describe it is that it is something that is distressing to people, and it is the discrepancy or the difference between the relationships you actually have and those that you wish you had.
That's Dr. Carla Perisunoto, the Associate Chief for Geriatrics Clinical Programs at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Perisunoto says that while loneliness is largely subjective, the term social isolation is similar and easier to measure.
Social isolation is actually something that's more quantifiable in terms of the number of relationships and the types of relationships that someone has. So another way to think about it also is right now during the COVID pandemic, there are people that, because of physical distancing policies, are becoming socially isolated because they literally have fewer relationships than they did prior to the pandemic.
A recent report Perisunoto worked on for the National Academies of Sciences looked at the health impacts of social isolation and loneliness among seniors. I asked her to walk me through some of the major findings from that research.
Really, we need to think about both loneliness and isolation as a new and emerging public health concern that cannot be ignored by our healthcare communities because of the health effects, which include everything from increased risk of loss of independence for adults, increased mortality, increased risk of cardiovascular diseases, which include heart attacks and strokes, worsened diabetes, worsened depression, worsened cognitive impairment and dementia, frailty. The health effects are really so profound that the report summarized that if we do not pay attention to this growing public health problem, we are going to see significant worsening or potentially worsening of chronic health problems in older adults.
I mean, you mentioned some of those long-term impacts. How are we able to determine what will leave long-lasting impressions on seniors? What loneliness now can mean for their future of their health tomorrow?
So that is really one of the fundamental questions, and why, while we have quite a bit of research right now, that is a question that we still do not know, and why many of us who work and do research in this space are particularly concerned about the pandemic. And what I mean by that is the public health policies that we are developing now, which are to create physical distancing, are incredibly important in the now in terms of reducing the spread of COVID during the pandemic. The concern is that we do not know how long it takes for someone to have lasting effects from loneliness and isolation. So it is possible that even a week, a month of this could have lasting effects. And so that is a great concern.
I feel like I'm hearing anecdotally from a lot of my friends and just people that I know that they seem to be upping the number of phone calls or even video chats with the seniors in their lives. Are things like phone calls or video chats considered meaningful contact that can actually ease feelings of loneliness for seniors?
That is a tough question to answer. And I think the hope is that yes, but we don't know in reality. I think the way we think about it is that some contact may be better than no contact. And for two reasons. One, it is reminding that senior older adult that they're not alone and that someone's thinking about them. But we don't know what meaningful is because that's very subjective. And I've seen a couple things also anecdotally in my own patients or in my own community that for some, it makes them actually feel potentially a little bit more isolated because they miss that person even more by not being able to see them. The other part about this is that what happens post-pandemic? Are we going to go back to where we were before, which is unfortunately ignoring older adults? We live in an incredibly ageist country and world where we often just relegate older adults to the sidelines. And so while it is fantastic that we are finally remembering older adults, is that there is some fear amongst the older adult community that we will go back to ignoring them once this is all done.
I'm thinking about seniors who have limited financial resources, especially. Is this period of isolation going to impact them more severely than others?
Yeah. So in the research that I've done in terms of looking at who were the people that expressed higher degrees of loneliness, the study that I did showed that people who were older, women, people from minority groups, and lower socioeconomic status were at greater risk and reported higher rates of loneliness. And what we're seeing now during times of pandemic is that, you know, stretching your money further is harder. The other thing that I'm finding, if you think about both the healthcare aspect and just the social component of phone calls and video, many of my own patients who are low income don't have data plans, for example, that can support video visits. And so I tried to have a video visit with one of my patients 2 weeks ago, and the patient's daughter said, I just can't do that because we don't have a plan that supports that, or we don't have internet. And so that means we're actually leaving a pretty big segment of the population out. And so if we don't think about as a country or as a healthcare system where I work, how to reach and help people who are low income and who are, you know, across the digital divide or marginalized, we're missing a big segment of the population, and particularly worsening health and mental health for people who are already quite vulnerable.
I know that you also have a 76-year-old mother who was living on her own at the early stages of the outbreak. And now, from what I understand, she's living with your family, right?
She is. Yeah. And I think, you know, what was really interesting about the decision with my mom is that, you know, here I am, a geriatrician and palliative medicine doctor doing this as a profession, and finding myself having the same conversations with my mother that I do with my patients, which is, how do we get through this period? What are your risks? And what do you do if you get sick? And I think what was important with my mom is that we had a conversation and we said, Mom, what is important to you? And, you know, what kind of risk do you want to accept? And how do we make sure we protect you and are being, you know, good citizens and making sure we're not putting other people at risk? I think many other people are just making automatic decisions for older adults and saying, we're not going to see you and you stay here and we stay here. And in my family, we had a conversation, and my mom was already experiencing loneliness after the death of my father a year and a half ago. And as a family, we decided, you know, why don't you come stay with us and we'll take it on a week by week basis.
What's your advice for people whose loved ones are older and either living alone or maybe living in a long-term care facility? And as the other part of that question, I mean, what's your advice for older people themselves who might be listening and feeling some of this loneliness?
I think there's two parts. It's exactly what I've done with my mother, which is have the conversation. Don't make assumptions. Don't make decisions for the older adult. And for the older adults who are listening, make your voice heard. There's a lot of things that are assumed about what you want and don't want, and it's important that we know what's actually important to you. My mom was willing to take a certain amount of risk and in order to be with people. There's also this part that it's been completely extrapolated to saying zero contact, when really it's thinking about prolonged contact and minimizing risk. And so how do you do those things? So as we move forward, the conversations we need to have with our families or our friends who are older is, how can we start to reintroduce social connection and visits, and doing it in a measured way? It doesn't mean we're suddenly going to go from zero contact to a party of 50 people, but maybe one visit at a time and spaced out so we can monitor those. And it's also thinking about, should I get sick? What is important to me? And what are my wishes? Do I want to be in the hospital? Do I want to be on a ventilator? All those questions that are very hard for people to talk about. But frankly, now is the time to really think about that and ask our friends and our parents and our loved ones who are older, and for the older adult to make their wishes known. Sometimes the kids are more uncomfortable talking about it than the actual older person.
Dr. Carla Parisinotto is the Associate Chief for Geriatrics Clinical Programs at the University of California, San Francisco. Thank you so much, Dr. Parisinotto.
Thank you.
Only the lonely know each melody.
Luckily, there are a lot of folks out there thinking about how to support older people right now.
How people can help is to reach out to your older friends and neighbors, but keep a significant distance.
That's Mark Merity, the executive director of DEROTE, a New York City-based nonprofit that works to alleviate social isolation for older people. We asked him for his take on what people can do to support the aging population during COVID-19, even though in-person visits are not yet an option.
Even as some states begin to open up, keeping that social distancing away from older adults is really critical. And for me, who have spent a vast majority of my career in the field of aging, it breaks my heart to tell people that they have to keep away from older adults. But the reality is today that it is absolutely essential until we're able to bring this virus under control.
But Mark also said there's a lot we can do right now, even for those who might not have easy access to technology, as is the case with many older Americans.
What people can do is they can pick up the telephone and call an older friend, call an older neighbor, call an older relative that you may not have spoken to for many years. Now's the time to pick up the phone. For those that do have access to technology, on our website, deroteusa.org, we have new guides that we have created where people can help older adults walk through how to use their smartphones, how to use Zoom, how to use WhatsApp, so that they too can connect and be able to cross that digital divide and stay connected with other people.
And for our older takeaway listeners, he has a message for you.
My message to older adults is, first, thank you. You have contributed an enormous amount to our society, and because of what you've been able to do, you have enriched all of our lives. Second, I would say that it's really important not to be afraid to reach out. It's important to reach out to your friends and to your neighbors. You can be just as much of an assist, help others by your reaching out as others can be for reaching out to older adults.
Head to thetakeaway.org for links to resources for the elderly from the National Council on Aging, including support lines for those experiencing loneliness. We'll keep talking on the show about COVID-19's effect on the older population. And if you yourself are older and you would like to share your experience, including if you've been dealing with isolation and loneliness, call us, leave us a message at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can send an email to takeawaydigital@gmail.com. It's been more than a century since the influenza pandemic of 1918. That's the deadliest pandemic in recent history, with at least 50 million deaths worldwide. And although many things have changed in the years since, the historic pandemic offers some lessons for today, especially right now, as more states relax their social distancing measures put in place because of COVID-19. For more on this, we turn to Alex Navarro, the assistant director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan.
There were four waves of the disease. Some say three, it depends on how you count them. There was a spring of 1918 wave that was not very deadly. Then there was the deadly fall wave that started In really late August in the military camps and into early September in the Northeast. And then it spread out across the country from there, and it hit other cities, usually end of September, early October. It lasted through the fall, and then there was another wave right on the heels of that wave in the winter of 1919. And in some cities, those two waves sort of merged as one in some ways. And then there was another wave in the winter of 1920.
Ooh, all right, that's a lot of waves. So I know that some U.S. cities decided to put in place some social distancing measures. Were those measures similar to the social distancing measures we're seeing now?
They weren't quite as sweeping, generally speaking. Most places, but not all cities, closed schools. And they also tended to close places of public amusement. So things like movie theaters, performance theaters, pool halls, dance halls. They oftentimes closed, or at least recommended, the closure of churches. And they would oftentimes, but not always, close saloons. And they would have gathering bans, sometimes applying only to indoor gathering bans, and also sometimes applying to outdoor bans as well. And that was generally the level of closure order. So they weren't as sweeping as today with the stay-at-home orders and with a more sweeping closure of all non-essential businesses.
And you're saying they were deciding to close this and they were deciding to close that. Is that the federal government in that case, or were those decisions being made on the state level or even lower down municipality, county level?
Right. So those decisions were all made at the local or state level, depending on how those public health offices operated. There were plenty of states that issued statewide closure orders. Some of them recommended closure orders and allowed the final decision to be left with the local municipalities. There really was not a very strong federal response. Public health was and still remains the domain of states and local governments. The United States was at war at the time, so President Wilson was supremely involved in making sure that mobilization continued. He was already looking to the post-World War I world with the League of Nations and that sort of thing. The federal response was largely relegated to controlling the epidemic in the military camps, and there were a handful of circulars that went out throughout the fall from the United States Public Health Service, as well as the Surgeon General's office, saying, okay, this is what you should be on the lookout for. This is what influenza looks like, making posters so that people knew not to cough and sneeze into their hand, but to use a handkerchief. And the Public Health Service did recommend that cities and states at least consider these types of gathering bans and closure orders as a way of helping to control the epidemic. But that was essentially the federal response.
How long were those closure orders and those social distancing guidelines in place?
It varied from community to community, and typically it was about 3 to 5 weeks or so was about the average, and it depended on how the epidemic was unfolding in each community. Most cities outside of the Northeast in particular, when they removed, they thought they were coming down the other side of the curve and their epidemics were over, and they removed those social distancing orders and those gathering bans too soon, and they faced a second spike of cases. And in some cities, that second spike was actually higher than the first.
And what else did they do beside banning large gatherings and putting these social distancing guidelines into place?
So in a handful of cities, they also implemented mandatory masking orders. In some cities, they were recommended, but in the West Coast, in, for example, Denver, Seattle, Oakland, San Francisco, they mandated that masks be worn. And that was met with a great deal of opposition, particularly in San Francisco. They often allowed people to make homemade masks out of any number of materials. As cotton gauze became scarce, they recommended using linen in San Francisco to entice women in particular to wear masks. They said you can make them out of chiffon. So the type of material didn't really matter. It was more as long as you're covering your face with something. And people got quite creative. They wanted to be able to smoke and wear a mask at the same time, so they would stitch a little flap over the mouth or all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, and we've been seeing protests pop up around the country right now against different stay-at-home orders in various states and the wearing of face masks today. I mean, can you tell me a little bit more about public perception in 1918? It sounds like you're saying a lot of people didn't like wearing their face masks, but other than that, how did people view the outbreak and their personal responsibility in it?
It's a little bit hard to judge that through just the newspaper reporting, you know, from 100 years ago. But what we can say is that, generally speaking, there seemed to be fairly widespread compliance. Sometimes business owners did gripe, but in a lot of places they realized that you know, if you're a theater owner and there's an epidemic going on, that people aren't going to buy tickets anyway. And so initially, at least, there was a great push to try and control the epidemic as much as possible and to get through that crisis as quickly as possible. And you also have to remember this is a time of war. And so there's a lot of patriotic nationalism running through society, and people really want to feel like they're doing their part on the home front. That starts to wane, however, you know, within 3 to 5 weeks these orders last. As people start to hear the reports that cases and deaths are on a decline, they think the epidemic is over. They don't realize that these orders, these social distancing orders, are just flattening the curve and bending it around the other side, and that the disease is still out there. And so, you know, we start to see in most of these cities at least some pressure, if not high levels of grumbling, to reopen the city and get back to life as normal. And then after, of course, November 11th, when you have the Armistice Day and the end of the war, I think that's really, like in the case of San Francisco, why you see such widespread opposition, because you no longer have that patriotic drive to do what's right for society. People are just tired of living under the restrictions of wartime and then under the restrictions of the epidemic, and they want to return to life as normal.
So there were many different approaches to the flu pandemic in 1918, all across the U.S., even down to different cities having different approaches. Are there specific cities or states that responded especially well?
There are a handful of cities that really got it right. They had a very quick, what we call a public health response time. So they implemented these closure orders very quickly before or right around the time that their epidemics hit the acceleration phase. Other cities like San Francisco, for example, did not. They had a very delayed response, 10, 11 days before they implemented these closure orders and these gathering bans. You know, some cities had very forceful public health leaders. St. Louis is a great example, with Max Starkloff, who was very willing to gather and accept the best data of the day and to change his mind as more data came in. Initially, he was not for closure orders, but when he realized the epidemic was in the city, he changed gears.
Yeah, maybe you can tell us which cities serve as a cautionary tale.
One would be Denver. Denver removed their closure orders and gathering bans right on Armistice Day, November 11th. A lot of cities did that. And they thought that their epidemic was over. And of course, now it's Armistice Day. Everyone is celebrating the end of the war, as well as what they think is the end of the epidemic and the end of these closure orders. And everyone crowds downtown, and they go to theaters, and there are lines out the doors, and they go to auditoriums, et cetera. And within a matter of days, cases and then subsequently deaths start to increase, and quite dramatically. Mm-hmm. Denver implemented for just a few hours a second closure order, but it was so unpopular.
Did you say for a few hours?
Yes. Literally just for an afternoon. It was so unpopular with business leaders, especially theater owners. They marched down to City Hall and they demanded that it be rescinded. And to placate them, the health officer and the mayor removed that order and they implemented a mandatory mask order instead. And of course, masks were made out of gauze. They were very porous. And if you're not going to implement a mask order alongside social distancing orders, they weren't all that helpful. They may have helped a little bit, but probably not that much. San Francisco is another great example. San Francisco does something similar. They had a first mask order that came right at the end of their closure order period. They lifted all the orders together, and the masks were not very popular. People didn't like wearing them. They lift their orders. People go back to life as normal, and they see another spike of cases and deaths. And that increased quite significantly. And by early January of 1919, they realized they needed to do something. So they implemented a mandatory mask order, but they didn't implement any other closure orders. That second mask order was met with widespread opposition. There were numerous reports of people being arrested for not wearing their masks and being fined. There was a group that was formed in opposition called the Anti-Mask League. At least 2,000 people at one point met in an auditorium in the city to protest the wearing of masks and this new ordinance. One of the members of the Anti-Mask League was, in fact, also a member of the city's Board of Supervisors, so the county and the city legislative body. And there were many prominent physicians who also were on the Anti-Mask League who didn't believe that masks worked and along with others, believed that it was an infringement on their civil liberties.
Now, of course, the healthcare infrastructure was so different back then. What did the 1918 pandemic do to the nation's hospitals?
Completely overran them. In just about every city, hospitals were completely swamped with cases very quickly. This was an incredibly explosive disease. Influenza was not a mandatory reportable disease at the start of the epidemic in any city, meaning that physicians were not required to report cases to local health authorities, and therefore the health officers really had no idea how many cases they had. Now, that changed early on in pretty much every city. They made it a reportable disease. But early on, they have no idea how many cases are out there. And so then suddenly they're faced with this onslaught of cases. There's a lack of physicians and nurses because most of them are serving for the war effort either in American military camps on the outskirts of cities or overseas. You know, there's this mass number of cases, temporary hospitals and field hospitals that needed to be erected in most communities. They needed to shuttle non-critical patients to other hospitals and make space for influenza patients and pneumonia patients in some of the larger city hospitals. And healthcare was far more rudimentary than we have today. Although this was germ theory, they understood how influenza spread. They thought it was bacterial and not a viral disease. They didn't realize that for another decade.
So how did the 1918 pandemic finally end?
Well, by that time, they were keeping track of the cases and the deaths, although it was not perfect. They had a pretty good sense of it. And they could track and plot the epidemic curve. And it basically ended because, as we know now, influenza becomes a seasonal phenomena. There are some years that are worse than others. And then we get these epidemic strains that are far more deadly, generally speaking. And in 1918, we had that very deadly fall wave. And then each subsequent wave, as more and more people got sick and recovered, each subsequent wave attenuated and that peak got lower and lower until the H1N1, which was the strain that was circulating, became one of the seasonal influenza strains that circulated for the next couple of decades.
So as we're seeing more states starting to reopen right now, what are some lessons that they should look back to the 1918 pandemic and try and learn from?
You know, given, of course, that the historical context is different, this is 100 years later, but also that perhaps human nature doesn't change all that much, I think one of the lessons is that closure orders and these gathering bans are very difficult to reimplement a second time after they're removed. And that was certainly the case in 1918. You know, the will to issue those orders largely evaporated, with the possible exception of school closures, which did happen in many communities the second time around. There really just wasn't the will to enter into those more sweeping closure orders and gathering bans. And so you see things like face mask orders alone, or they would reduce capacity in theaters. But that was about it, you know, as the epidemic rolled on. And I think many people and even public health officers became resigned to the fact that the epidemic and therefore cases and deaths would simply continue to run its course and that there wasn't a whole lot that could be done. So I think that's one of the lessons. We need to be very careful when lifting these orders, because if we have to remove them or have to implement them rather a second time around, it can be very difficult. And so we definitely need something to replace that community mitigation effort, or I think we're going to be in trouble. The other lesson is to be very careful about what lessons we actually draw from 1918. And I've seen a lot of social media posts about how closure orders in 1918 were not as sweeping as today and that they were shorter and, you know, that they managed to get through the epidemic all the same. And of course, they did get through the epidemic, but it was with a staggering loss of life. And I think if cities had enacted stricter measures and had kept them in place for longer, I think they undoubtedly would have had better outcomes. So the other lesson is to not do what they did in 1918. The lesson is to do better than they did in 1918.
Alex Navarro is the Assistant Director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Alex, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What if your political leadership was actively running ad campaigns against cautious measures like social distancing? What if that leader was the president? Well, that's exactly what's happening in Brazil. For weeks since COVID-19 began spreading there, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has dismissed its seriousness. He's called it a little flu, and he's undermined governors and public health experts in fighting it. As of this week, there were more than 100,000 cases recorded, with around 8,000 deaths, although experts think there could be many more. To help us understand all of this, I'm joined by Marina Lopez, the Washington Post's Brazil correspondent. Hi, Marina.
Hi there.
And I'm also joined by Jessica Rich, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and the author of State-Sponsored Activism, Bureaucrats and Social Movements in Democratic Brazil. Hi to you, Jessica.
Hello.
Marina, I'll start with you. You normally live in Sao Paulo, Brazil, but you got stuck here in the U.S. due to the coronavirus. How would you compare Brazil's handling of the virus and the outbreak to the United States' handling?
That's right. So it was actually really interesting because I was on maternity leave. I wanted to come see my family. They live here in Florida. And the situation in Brazil was so calm that I didn't quite realize the magnitude of the problem. I got on a plane with my two-month-old. I thought that would be safe. I got here to the States. And it was only really when I got here that I realized, oh, this is going to be much bigger than we expected in Brazil. At the time, this was in early March. Most Brazilians didn't think that this would affect them. It wasn't really on the news. And it was something that was seen as this outside worry, something that was happening in China, maybe starting to happen a little bit in California and in other places in the U.S., but not something that would affect our daily lives. And it was only when I arrived here, the day after I arrived, the stock market crashed. And that night, I called my husband and I said, I need you to, you know, bring our other son who's 2 years old to be with us here in the U.S. because I don't think I can get back on a plane with a two-month-old. This is much more serious than we had in mind. American Airlines stopped flights coming going from Brazil that night.
Oh, and wow.
He was able to get on the very last flight out and we were able to be reunited here. And so now we're following, you know, the what's happening in Brazil from the U.S. and trying to figure out when do we go back? When is it safe for you to bring a child back into a situation this chaotic and this disorganized? And we're still waiting. We don't know when we're going to be able to go back home to São Paulo.
Well, congrats on the new one, first of all. And Marina, I saw the news that just this week I've been looking at the numbers and Brazil's numbers have surpassed China's in terms of confirmed cases and deaths. Can you give us just an overview of how COVID-19 is affecting Brazil and how accurate the record keeping is there?
Yes. So one of the problems here is that we really don't know because there's been such a lack of testing. Only 11% of the tests that are available in Brazil have actually been distributed. And so what we're seeing is bodies showing up at morgues that are unidentified. They don't know why these people died. They suspect it's COVID, but there's no real way of knowing because they haven't been tested. Mm-hmm. Another issue here is that we don't know when the peak of the pandemic is hitting the different cities in Brazil. So it's very hard for governors and for administrators to decide when to open things back up when you don't know if there's more coming, if the worst has already passed. I've also seen situations where people who should get tests, who need to be tested, are not getting tested. So I was speaking to a doctor last week whose family got coronavirus. He's going into hospitals, he's treating patients, and he doesn't know if he has the virus or not. He doesn't know if he's asymptomatic, but everybody in his house has tested positive. He cannot get a test, and he's going and treating people, treating pregnant women at hospitals without knowing if he's a vector for this disease. So it really becomes complicated when you don't have information, and it complicates the federal response to this pandemic. People are just going into this blind, not knowing where they are in the pandemic and how to best utilize the resources in different hospitals because there's just no numbers, there's no information.
Jessica, tell us about the medical infrastructure in Brazil. Is the country prepared for an outbreak like this in terms of resources and healthcare staff?
So the public health system, I would say, is one of the major challenges to this coronavirus response in Brazil, but it's also a major resource going forward, which is to say that the challenge is that the public health system is incredibly underfunded. It's really underfunded, and in particular, the public hospital infrastructure is underfunded, especially in states like Rio that already didn't have enough beds to treat people, that certainly don't have enough PPP, but also don't have other basic supplies. So you can see that hospitals are already at capacity and beyond capacity in a number of states in Brazil. So I think that's a real challenge. Brazil, unlike the United States, actually has a national health system, and there is a constitutional right to public health in Brazil, which basically means that even though it's incredibly underfunded, there is a vast primary care system that exists in Brazil. And so going forward, if and when tests are available, there's an infrastructure for a testing and tracing and social isolation approach to combating the pandemic. But as it is, the system is incredibly underfunded. And you can see that. I mean, just in terms of when you talk to doctors and nurses, like Marina was saying, I think some of them are quitting. They're incredibly frustrated and scared about what's happening at the moment.
So, Jessica, can you tell us how the president there, Bolsonaro, has been talking about the pandemic and messaging about the pandemic?
It's funny I mean, funny in a sort of tragicomic way, when I hear people talking about Trump's denial of coronavirus here in the United States, because every time Trump says something that's minimizing the seriousness of the situation, I hear something that Bolsonaro says that's like 100 times worse. So he completely denies that this is a problem at all. He's called it just a little flu. He's told Brazilians they should be fighting the virus like a man, not like a little boy. In late March, he actually took out a $1 million TV ad that encouraged people to please carry on like normal. He himself has been going out into the streets, shaking hands with crowds. So you get these amazingly terrifying photo ops. Like, there's one of him wiping his nose and shaking hands with an elderly person after he wiped his nose who was wearing a mask. So he's not only denied, you know, the problem, but he's actively making it worse and challenging other politicians who are trying to advocate for social isolation.
Marina, are people in Brazil concerned by their president right now?
I think, like in so many other areas, coronavirus really has delivered a magnifying glass through which to view Brazil. And Brazil was already a country that was very polarized before this. But when you have such a splintered response from the president and from the government in general, the president is saying, carry on as normal. Let's get Brazil to open up again. And you have governors saying, please stay at home. You have scientists saying, this is only going to get worse if you don't implement some social isolation measures. You really see that division more clearly in Brazil. So Bolsonaro supporters are taking to the streets. They're going to rallies. And at the same time, you see a lot of Brazilians very scared that this could get worse. And I think it's worth mentioning here that unlike the United States, 60% of Brazilian workers are what we call informal workers. They don't get a steady paycheck. They don't have a relationship with a company that's, you know, a legal official relationship. And so those workers have been hit the hardest by this. These are the street vendors, people who really live paycheck to paycheck and don't have a steady paycheck coming in. They are really suffering economically right now. So when the president says, I really want to open the government back up if only these pesky scientists would let me, he's catering to this electorate and he's thinking about the next election. He wants the support of the voters who are really suffering economically here. So I don't think it's just, you know, the president is crazy and out of his mind. I think there is a strategy behind this. And so this splintered response from the government has divided the country. Brazil is the only country that I can think of that's facing now a public health crisis, an economic crisis, and a political crisis with a president who has no cohesion with Congress at a time when you need Congress to be passing stimulus bills to help people economically. You need a united effort to combat the public health crisis that the country is facing. It really could not come at a worse time. With an administration that is losing more and more support from the public and from Congress every single week.
And what about local leaders and governors? Aside from the president, Marina, how are these lower level leaders or more localized leaders responding to the crisis? And are they doing anything to offer relief for people, as you said, who are working and who need to keep working at a time like this?
Congress has passed a stimulus bill. It's a one-time check that Brazilians who are informal workers get. So it's equivalent to about 1 month's salary for these low-income workers. It's around $200 US. And that's been a lot for most of these workers. It's helped them get through the last month. Now, the month has passed and they need something to help them get through the rest of the crisis, the next few months. We don't really know how long it's going to last. For that, you still need a lot of cohesion within Congress. And Brazil's Congress is not known for that. There are 36 different political parties. Getting anything passed is difficult in the best of times. And now with the way the president has been behaving, it's become even harder. A lot of Brazil's governors have shut down businesses. They are keeping kids at home and shutting down schools. But it really varies state to state. And in some states, like in Manaus, in northern Brazil, in the middle of the Amazon, you really see a health system that's completely collapsing, that there are no more beds, there are no more ventilators. And so the crisis is more acute in certain areas, certain parts of the country. In other parts of the country, people don't understand what the big deal is, and they're calling for a return to normalcy, much like what you see in the U.S. Brazil is a continental-sized country, and so it affects the country differently in different parts.
Jessica, there's been talk of a potential impeachment process for some time now, unrelated to Bolsonaro's handling of the virus outbreak. Remind us what that was about, and where do those investigations stand now?
A number of people have wanted to push forward an impeachment process for a while, and there's a new potential for investigating the president with the exit of the very popular Minister of Justice, who was popular among Bolsonaro supporters, who essentially quit his job last week and in quitting gave a very long, very scathing speech accusing the president of misconduct. And that has led to a new opportunity for the Supreme Court actually to push forward some investigations of criminal wrongdoing. I don't know what the prospects are of any of them really gaining traction at the moment. The president's popularity, it's hard to tell how popular he is, because the best way of doing these public opinion polls is in person, which you obviously can't do during a pandemic.
Right. But his
popularity is around, estimates are 25%, which is incredibly low, but it's actually not low enough to be around where presidents usually get impeached. So, you know, you've got a very low base of support, but it's a very strong base of support who will continue to support him basically no matter what he does. And, you know, just like in the United States, politicians pay attention to approval ratings and popularity. And so they're kind of waiting to see whether to push forward any of these proposals. So nothing's happening in Congress right now, but I do think anything can change in the future.
Jessica Rich is assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and author of State-Sponsored Activism, Bureaucrats and Social Movements in Democratic Brazil. Marina Lopez is the Washington Post's Brazil correspondent. Jessica, Marina, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. It's The Takeaway. I'm Shamita Basu. You know, I just read the story that Tom Cruise is going to film a movie in space. He had apparently used Elon Musk's SpaceX rocket and filmed the whole thing in orbit. Well, that's definitely one way to social distance on a movie set, right? Anyway, he has the time. His Mission Impossible sequel has been delayed, as have many of the blockbuster franchises that we know and, well, sometimes love. As some parts of the country start to reopen, Hollywood is starting to look ahead to how studios will eventually reopen too. But things could be really different for filmmakers, for actors, pretty much for everyone involved in movie production in a post-pandemic world. Joining us to help us understand what it'll take to revive Hollywood and what changes we'll see is Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic and culture reporter at Vox.com, and filmmaker Sophia Takal. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
It's good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Alyssa, give us a sense of the impact of the pandemic so far on the film industry. We're talking productions getting canceled, releases being delayed. Countless jobs have been lost, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, initially it started with productions hitting pause with, you know, for what they said might be a week or two. Then it became clear that, you know, there with the lockdown orders that it wasn't possible for people to gather on big sets. Film sets are already kind of breeding grounds for disease. So when you add a highly contagious virus to the mix, that's a problem. And now that's kind of spiraled into films that were in production that shut down are now being delayed. So at this point, it looks like there isn't really a summer movie season. And even if theaters were to reopen, there's not a lot of movies left to put in them at the moment.
And Sophia, did the pandemic affect you at all as a filmmaker or any of the projects you're working on?
A lot of projects that I'd been talking about shooting this year definitely aren't happening. And projects that were not as far along in development in terms of like finding cast, those are all also sort of slowed down. The one lucky thing is that I'm also a writer, and development and writing really hasn't slowed down. And there seems to be an interest in finding stories that people can tell within the new reality of having to make more contained, smaller films or TV shows. And so that seems to be where a lot of people's heads are at right now, is developing work that once, you know, the quarantine ends, can be made on a smaller scale than things were being made before.
Now, Steven Soderbergh, who directed the film Contagion, which is about a pandemic and which a lot of people have been watching right now, has been tapped to lead the Directors Guild Task Force, which is coming up with workplace guidelines for movie sets post-COVID. Alyssa, do we have a sense of what that task force is planning?
You know, right now, I think they're partly looking towards governments to see what kind of guidelines are going to be coming from the states and, you know, maybe even from the federal government. But also, you know, I think what we know is that Soderbergh in particular is a director who's known for being very innovative, and he's always trying to kind of find efficiencies and ways to kind of make films in more efficient ways. And so he's actually probably a really good leader for this. But at the same time, we do know that, you know, a lot is going to depend, for instance, on what unions are deciding about what are safe workplaces for their workers and what kinds of abilities large or small groups will have to gather. So there's a lot of things that are up in the air, and the Directors Guild is one piece of that, but it's also going to depend on all the other guilds that, you know, that different people in Hollywood work as part of, and then also independent productions, you know, whether there's money, ability to get resources, whether there's locations, whether we can, I think the most important part of all of this might be whether there's testing available so that people can maybe guarantee a small, closed, safe set. I think that will have a big, big impact on the kind of work that people can make going forward.
Alyssa, are there any studios that have plans to start production anytime soon?
So right now, I don't know of any. I'm sure that there are many conversations going on about this. There are also small projects going on here and there. You know, to so for instance, you know, Parks and Recreation did their own kind of socially distanced episode. That's right. Saturday Night Live has been doing the same thing, and it's been pretty successful. There have been a couple other instances of this, and I'm sure everyone is scrambling right now to think about which, you know, what kind of shows do they have that they might be able to produce in a kind of a separate way. It's funny to think about, for instance, a show like Netflix's reality show The Circle is actually predicated on the idea that everyone's in a different spot and they can't be in the same place. That's part of the game. So you can sort of imagine versions of these things going forward. But again, you know, nobody really wants that to be what the future of entertainment looks like. And so much is going to depend on, do we have tests? Can we say, okay, everyone on this set is not infected? And do we have the ability to quarantine people who are sick and kind of care for, you know, for people's health, which is everyone's, hopefully everyone's first concern. But I do think that we're going to see smaller productions and, like Sophia was saying, more contained productions coming back before we see these huge scale, massive budget projects. I mean, you just can't imagine a Mission Impossible traveling the globe, shooting in all these different countries in the next year or so.
We're not getting a new Marvel movie anytime soon. Is that what you're saying?
No, but of course they've delayed so many films that we still have several years of that content in the can.
Backlog, sure. Sophia, for you personally, what would you need to be in place to feel comfortable being on a set again?
You know, that really depends, again, on the size of the production. I made a film called Always Shine that I shot with a crew of five and with mainly two actors, and we all lived in a house together. And something like that, I feel like I'd feel comfortable doing even now, where, you know, maybe part of the prep schedule is including a 2-week quarantine where everyone's isolated and then we all come together, you know, after getting tested to make sure that we're all healthy. And then, you know, these kinds of like smaller indie films that I came up making make sense with this model. I think to make, you know, bigger movies, it would require a lot more testing and, of course, and just making sure that everyone, you know, safety protocols are in place. But those safety protocols also, to me, are a little bit contradictory to what I love about making movies, which is, you know, community and feeling close to the people you're working with. And the idea of physical distancing feels a little bit challenging, particularly with actors working together. How do you know, shoot scenes. I've been talking about this with a lot of my filmmaker friends. Like, are you using longer lenses? Are you blocking scenes where people aren't together? And how do you really make art in that context? It's challenging to think about.
Mm. Now, looking beyond film production, there's also the question of theater reopenings. Sophia, do you think people will feel safe and want to go out to the movie theaters again anytime soon?
I really am not sure the timeline for when people might want to go to the movies, but I'm very hopeful that this experience of people being isolated from one another will actually remind audiences what's so great about the movies, this communal experience of watching something and experiencing something together. So even if it takes a little bit of time, my hope is that people are eager and excited to get out and see movies on the big screen again.
Hmm. Alyssa, is streaming going to become more dominant, do you think, because of this outbreak? Or do theater chains still have a lot of sway in Hollywood?
I think time will tell. A big question will be which theaters and theater chains are able to survive being shut down. So I think the question of sway may still be up in the air. I do think that one form of streaming might become more dominant, which is that during this this sort of period of lockdown, we've seen some independent and art house distributors pivot to something they've been calling virtual theatrical, which is where they partner with various theaters, independently owned theaters, to release a movie as a sort of a streaming rental at home, and then split the money with the theater and the distributor. And while I don't think you're going to see people who love going to their local art house theater dropping off once this happens, I think everyone, like Sophia said, is going to be very excited to be back in the theater. But I do think there are cases in which movies were only released in a select number of cities, and theaters might even benefit from, you know, continuing to use this virtual theatrical model where someone who's a huge film lover but lives in a place where there isn't an art house theater or one that would have this film might be able to still buy it and watch the film and then be able to discuss it with their friends or be part of the conversation in a way that we didn't see before. So that's the kind of thing I really hope we'll see, is more accessibility of films, just because we've seen some models that might work in ways that can benefit theaters and filmmakers, even after theaters reopen in whatever state that looks like it's going to be.
Alyssa, you've also written a little bit about how you think this is going to have long-term implications for things like film festivals and even award ceremonies. What's known and what's unknown right now about things like festivals and accolades?
Yeah, festivals are an interesting case this year. I mean, you know, obviously the Cannes Film Festival was supposed to start in about 2 weeks, and that is not going forward. The country is still under a pretty serious lockdown, and travel is difficult, and nobody wants to put that many people in one space. And that's kind of the issue with film festivals, is that they are designed to gather a lot of people into one space to see films. So much will depend on various countries and what their governments deem appropriate. But even the fall festival season, which is really, really important for launching films towards Oscar bids and things like that, for those who have that in their sights, those are really up in the air right now. And if they go forward, they're probably not going to look in 2020 like they usually do. And so that may change things. It may mean that some filmmakers want to hold their films back in the hopes that 2021 will look different. And it may also mean that we just don't get the same kind of Oscar season with all these prestige movies that we usually do. So there's an excellent chance, I think, that some of the smaller films that managed to come out this year digitally or maybe eventually in smaller theaters might actually have a run at awards in a way they may not have in a previous year that's more crowded with other kinds of films. And in anticipation of that, the Academy, which gives out the Oscars, and the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which gives out the Golden Globes, has said that films that were released to streaming and not theatrically from March 15th onward to an unspecified date will be eligible for those awards. So we may see some real interesting things going on at next year's awards ceremonies, which honestly feels like the least important thing right now to be thinking about, but it is something that, you know, everyone is always thinking about in the industry, and festivals and theaters are a big part of that.
Sophia, I'm wondering if you're thinking of it the way that I am, which is this slowdown is happening right now, and I'm just wondering what it's going to take to crank the whole film industry back up into production again. I mean, not only financially, but also workforce-wise, what do you think it's going to take or look like?
Yeah, I am definitely wondering that. I feel like a lot of people are in this industry and other industries too. You know, actually, Alyssa was talking about what it would take earlier, and I actually feel like one thing that I keep hearing about is just insurance companies being willing to insure productions. And that seems like another piece of the puzzle that I guess when they feel like it's safe to insure, then maybe more productions will go into place. But I'm kind of at a loss. It's such an overwhelming moment in time. And so processing everything that's going on in the world and then trying to think about what's going to happen in the movie industry, it's all sort of blending into one big question mark for me. Like, to me, you can't really separate what's going to happen to the future of, you know, our country and to the world with what's going to happen in one particular industry or another. So I'm wondering when it's going to start. I'm not like chomping at the bit to get back to work until it does feel very safe. And no one's life is going to be put at risk to work. I'm just not sure when that will be or what it would take.
Sophia Takal is the director and co-writer of the recently released horror movie Black Christmas. And Alyssa Wilkinson is a film critic and culture reporter at Vox.com. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for us today. Thank you for listening. As always, you can call in, you can share any thoughts about any of these stories at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can also send us a tweet at The Takeaway, and you can find me on Twitter at Shubasu. That's Shubasu. Really appreciate you being here. I'm Shamitha Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.